case, Mr. Pepper and Ms. Minix, you're still with us?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Then let's move to, and I'm probably mispronouncing the case, but Zelaya. Mr. Pepper, you'll have 15 minutes. Do you care to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 3 minutes for rebuttal.
3 minutes, yes. All right. That's 10:15 now. Good evening, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Paul Pepper with the Public Defender's Office, and I took over the appeal for Mr. Victor Zelaya in this case. Our office did represent him at trial. Essentially, I would just start out that I don't believe the facts are in dispute. In reading over the Attorney General's brief, I think that we all agree on the basic facts, and those essentially are this: that on October 22nd, 2017, at 1:56 in the morning, which is, of course is a late hour, at the Southport apartment complex, a security officer, David Namuthu, saw what he considered a suspicious vehicle in the parking lot with a male in the rear passenger seat who turned out to be Mr. Zelaya, and apparently he said he saw him holding a firearm.
This is Judge Frank. Didn't Zelaya admit that he was the guy in the back seat with the gun?
Not at the time of his seizure, Your Honor, and certainly not at the time that the officer told him to put his hands on his head. Mr. Zelaya did not testify at trial.
Mr. Pepper, yes. before you leave this particular portion of the facts, the caller was a security guard, and according to Officer Larson, testified that he wasn't sure if any of the occupants lived on the property and wanted the police to verify that they were not trespassing. Why isn't that standing alone a reasonable suspicion on behalf of the officer that criminal activity might be afoot?
Well, Your Honor, I think we can look at the Commonwealth versus Johnson decision cited in the AG's brief, which is the April 28, 2020 decision, Lexus 124, which was a case where it was a consensual encounter, and the officer had seized the individual because he thought, basically, do you live here? The fact that a security guard is saying, I think they might be trespassing, I understand that my take on this is because the security officer saw a weapon, he was afraid to go up to the car and ask him, do you live here? That doesn't make it a criminal activity. And in fact, the security guard didn't even know if they lived there or not. And so,
but he apparently had sufficient concern that they were trespassing to call the police. And all the officer needed is a reasonable suspicion. He doesn't have to be certain. He doesn't have to know for sure. It's just a reasonable, articulable suspicion. And I find that to be, I don't know what other police officer would be expected to do with that kind of information.
Well, Your Honor, I think that the officer certainly has a right to go to the scene. That makes sense. And has a right to approach the car. I don't know why the Attorney General in their brief were arguing that the officer didn't have a right to even approach the car. I don't think we made that argument at all. The point was this. What he saw, what he observed, articulate as his reasonable suspicion, was a statement by a security guard that maybe they're trespassing, and I saw the individual in the back holding a firearm. So the officer is approaching, and the car drives away. One thing I want to point out about this reasonable articulable suspicion is that even the circuit court judge, Judge Haddock, he said, well, he might have been thinking there was a robbery or a carjacking going on, which makes no sense. If the two individuals in the car with a police officer on scene are going to drive away, they have a police officer right there if they were just about to be robbed. That doesn't make any sense. And to say that, what the officer said was, he's investigating a trespass. But the first words out of his mouth when he's watching Mr. Zelaya stand there, not try to run away, no activity, he even states, I didn't see anything criminal activity at all. He says, put your hands on your head. That's a seizure, and it's not a consensual encounter. And the Attorney General makes a lot of stake on all these consensual encounter cases, which are completely different. This wasn't. A consensual encounter would have been, sir, I'm investigating. I'd like to talk to you, or you have a weapon on you. First of all, the officer, even at that moment, didn't even know if the gun was still in the car when it drove away. He had a hunch.
Wouldn't the officer have had a reasonable suspicion that the defendant was armed based on the information he had?
I think that he would have thought maybe it could be there, but that there has to be more than just a hunch that it could be. There has to be some sort of criminal activity.
It's not a hunch, though. The security guard said that there was a male sitting in the rear passenger seat that was holding a firearm. Now,
right.
that has got to be a reasonable suspicion that the individual is armed. The question becomes, is there a reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot?
Exactly.
Wouldn't that be a fair statement of where we are with this case?
I think you're right, although I don't concede that he should have seized him in the manner that he did. And I would go back to the case that I just cited, Johnson, that's the 2020 Lexis decision. There's a note about concealed weapon, and it's on page 3 of 8 of the decision, according to my printout, where it says that, thus courts do not presume that an individual carrying a concealed firearm must be in violation of the law. If there are other indicia of criminality present, the presence of a bulge or some other under totality of circumstances. Well, there isn't any other criminal activity. Even if the officer thinks, well, he could be carrying a concealed weapon, they can't use it. Without some criminal activity, if you're walking down the street and the officer thinks, you know, I think that bulge might be a concealed weapon, he can't tell that person, stop, put your hands up, if there's no other criminal activity. I mean,
well, let me stop you there and ask you if because I'm not sure that that issue's been resolved. The statute 18.2-308, the concealed weapon statute,
yes,
says that the existence of a permit authorizing the carrying of a concealed weapon is an affirmative defense. That being the case, why would the officer have the authority to stop someone, detain them, and then inquire as to whether or not they had a permit if he knew that they had a concealed weapon?
Well, my understanding of the case law is that you have to present your card, your permit, when demanded by the officer. And I don't think that the case law supports that an officer can just stop anybody walking down the street and he thinks he's got one and demand on the spot for his permit. I don't think that is the law.
Counsel, this is Judge Frank. Under the facts, what should the officer have done? Nothing?
No, I think the officer should have approached and said, sir, I need to speak with you. Do you live in this area? And do you have a firearm? That would have been a consensual encounter. What the officer did was escalate the situation to say, put your hands on your head. This had nothing to do with consent. It was an immediate demand. And I would submit that the case law, all these cases state that there has to be some criminal conduct or activity or about to, like in Terry, that the officer watching the individual is basically case the and he is suspicious that they are about to do something. Here, there's just an individual standing on the street and a car drove away. I submit that that's sufficient for the officer to demand for him to put his hands on his head. And the officer certainly had a right to go up to him, to sexual encounters, officer has the right to do that, and the individuals can say, I don't want to talk to you. I submit, Your Honor, that that's what the officer should have done.
Well, let me stop you there. You said earlier that a police officer having information, solid information, that a person has a concealed weapon is entitled to go up and ask the person if he has a permit, right?
If there's criminal activity. I think that, yep. I don't think that
okay,
the
so,
officer, okay. I guess the difference is, could an officer walk up to somebody and say, hey, you know, I noticed that bald under your armpit. Would you mind telling me if you're carrying a weapon? I mean, that's a consensual encounter.
Well, let me phrase it this way. Suppose a reputable citizen approached an officer and said, I just saw that guy over there put a pistol in his pocket. It's concealed. Now, that is more than reasonable suspicion. That's probably probable cause that he has a concealed weapon. Now, the question becomes, is he authorized to have one? Can the officer at that point walk up, detain the individual, and say, show me your permit?
I don't think so. I think
is there any case law to support that, think?
Well, Your Honor, if he has a right to carry a concealed weapon, first of all, then he has a right not to have an officer stop him and demand it unless there's some form of criminal activity.
Well, 308, 18.2-308 says it shall be an affirmative defense regarding a handgun that a person has been issued a valid concealed handgun permit. If it is an affirmative defense, isn't the obligation on the part of the individual with the gun to prove to the officer that he's entitled to carry it concealed?
Well, I think that according to the notes in the Lexis decision, they do not presume that the individual carrying a concealed firearm must be in violation of the law. If there are other indicia of criminality, the presence of a bulge can be considered under the totality of the circumstances of whether reasonable suspicion.
Mr. Pepper, this is Judge Huff. I just want to let you know you're in your 3 minutes rebuttal time. You're free to continue on if you want, but just wanted to give you the heads up.
I would just end by saying,
What case were you citing there, Mr. Pepper?
I'm citing in the Commonwealth versus Johnson Court of Appeals of Virginia, April 28, 2020, cited record number 1799-19-2.
That's an unpublished opinion, is it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it has no binding precedent on us.
No, but I think it goes to the logic. And I would just say that if an individual has a right to have a weapon, and an individual has a right to walk down the street, unless there's some form of criminal activity, an officer can't just say, you, stop, show me your permit. That's a seizure without any sort of reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, and that would be my point. And I'll end with that, Your Honor.
Oh, you have two minutes remaining, Ms. Minix?
Yes, Your Honor.
We're ready to hear from you, ma'am.
All right. Good morning, and may it please the court, Leanne Minix, on behalf of the Commonwealth in this matter. I'm happy to go straight to the Terry analysis, Your Honor. As to the seizure, I think that everyone agrees that Zelaya was seized when he complied with Officer Larson's instruction to raise his hand. And so then the court must determine whether at that time, and I would submit at that time, Officer Larson seized Zelaya and told him to raise his arm. He had a reasonable articulable suspicion that there was criminal activity, possibly afoot, and that Mr. Zelaya was armed and dangerous. As to the first part of the Terry analysis, the officer must have, or there must be objectively reasonable articulable suspicion that criminal activity may be afoot.
What is your position on whether an officer's knowledge that a person has a concealed weapon in and of itself is sufficient to warrant a Terry stop and inquiry?
Well, Your Honor, I would first point out that the Terry analysis does require the officer in the court to consider the totality of the circumstances. I think that this court has...
Let's get to my question. My question is very fundamental, not only to this case, but to others that we're dealing with. If an officer has a reasonable suspicion, or probable cause for that matter, that an individual is carrying a concealed weapon, is that sufficient indication of criminal activity to warrant a Terry stop, standing alone?
Your Honor, I think that standing alone, the case law would not support that, but this court, and I'm not sure, I'm not conceding that it's not, but I'm just saying that I think that this court has noted that the reasonable suspicion that an individual is carrying a concealed weapon may be sufficient for criminal activity to be afoot in totality of the circumstances. And I think that this court noted that in the Minter and the Beasley and the Andrews cases. I think that in those cases, that the officer and the court in those cases were considering the totality of the circumstances. I would point out that that was not the case here, because here the officer was investigating the report that he was not investigating a report of a concealed weapon when he reported to the scene. He was investigating a report that the fire alarm was in the open, but it was observed in the back seat. I would point out that the circuit court's factual findings that this was possibly a carjacking or a robbery, I believe, are supported by the record, and they are not plainly wrong. Those findings are noted on pages 94 and 114 of the appendix. And I think also the officer testified that he was investigating potential trespassing and any number of crimes that could involve firearms.
Do you even need those other possible findings of the Alcourt, anything beyond that there may well have been a trespass going on with these people that the security guard did not recognize that were in the parking lot but not in a parked space at 2 a.m. in the morning with a firearm in the back seat? Isn't that enough to support the reasonable, articulable suspicion requirement?
Yes, Your Honor, I would submit that it is, and I think that the credible report of firearm is what distinguishes this case from the findings in Yule, which did not involve the report of firearm and it was suspected drug activity. So, yes, Your Honor, I would submit that here that on its own would support a reasonable suspicion that there was criminal activity afoot. In addition to that, as the officer is approaching the car leaves. And viewing these circumstances through the trained eye of the law enforcement officer, as he's approaching, the car leaves, and the officer is left standing face-to-face in a parking lot with a person that he has reasonable suspicion to believe has a concealed firearm on him. Based on the totality of the circumstances, including the position of the car, the late hour, the credible report of the firearm, and the flight of the car from the parking lot, those all support the conclusion that criminal activity may have been afoot.
Is there any evidence that this car fled the scene? All I see is a car driving away and an officer hollering stop without any indication that the driver even heard it. How do we say this is car was fleeing the scene?
Your Honor, the car left. The circuit court found that essentially the group scattered. The car left. And viewing that through the eye of a trained law enforcement officer and including the disregard of his call for them to stop, which I'm not sure could be established whether or not they heard him. Based on all of that totality of the circumstances, it seems that criminal activity may have been afoot. And again, the law does not require the officer to be absolutely certain. And as this court has noted, and this is language from the Spence case, an officer need not suspect an individual of a particular crime in order to justify a Terry stop. General suspicion of some criminal activity is enough as long as the officer can, based on the circumstances before him, articulate a reasonable basis for his suspicion. At the time the car left, Officer Larson had to continue his investigation. It would have been unreasonable for him to turn away. And I think that the Supreme Court of the United States noted in Terry, it would have been poor police work for the officer in that case, who had observed what, the defense in that case argued was completely lawful conduct of men walking back and forth in front of a storefront over 20 times. The officer, drawing on his experience, determined that that was suspicious behavior. He thought they were going to commit a robbery. And so similarly here, it would have been poor police work for Officer Larson to walk away. He had a range of conduct that was possible, and contrary to Mr. Zelaya's position, it would have been unreasonable for the officer to approach Mr. Zelaya without taking some action to neutralize the potential danger to him. And I think that so this is the next step of the Terry analysis, which is the determination that Mr. Zelaya was armed and dangerous. And I believe this court's ruling in Jones states the controlling authority here, which is that at the time of the seizure, the officer had a reasonable, articulable suspicion. The defendant possessed a concealed weapon, and a reasonable suspicion of that offense, ipso facto, rendered him potentially armed and dangerous. And this court's rulings in Andrews, Beasley, and Center all note findings from this court that support that conclusion. So under Terry, an officer is permitted to conduct this risk if he believes the individual is armed and dangerous, which is the same inquiry as whether there is reasonable suspicion the defendant had a concealed weapon. Here, the circuit court's factual findings, I would submit, Your Honor, are supported by the record. The circuit court says that it took no great leap of faith to determine that the person who the security guard had observed sitting in the backseat of this identified vehicle holding a firearm was then the person who was standing outside the back passenger seat of the vehicle when the officer approached. I believe that the circuit court's finding is firmly supported by the record. And that is the most important factor here, is that report that the firearm had been observed, and then Officer Larson testified that he could no longer observe the firearm. So there certainly was a reasonable conclusion that the firearm was concealed on the defendant. And Your Honor, that brings us to the last step of the Terry inquiry, which is the scope of the frisk. And here, this frisk was a much less invasive arm raise. It was a minimally intrusive measure to immobilize Zelaya's hands. It was very reasonable in scope, and it was related to officer safety. And officer safety is the rationale behind the Terry pat-down frisk test. Courts have acknowledged things can escalate quickly. Officers have to make split-second decisions, and the officer does not have to be certain that the person is armed, although here the evidence certainly supported that conclusion. Officers are authorized to use a reasonable method of restraint, and the reasonableness is evaluated by considering the balancing. As I noted in the Commonwealth brief, the Ninth Circuit ruling from Enslin provides some persuasive guidance here, and in that case, the marshal directed the defendant to raise his arms, and the court there noted that although technically it was a seizure, it did not violate the Fourth Amendment because it wasn't unreasonable, and it was also a de minimis intrusion. Here, the circuit court similarly found that this intrusion was absolutely minimum, and the circuit court, the circuit court also found that it would have been incredibly ill-advised and dangerous for the officer to approach Mr. Zelaya, since he had a reasonable, articulable suspicion that Mr. Zelaya possessed a firearm and that it was concealed. And contrary to the appellant's position, I submit that factual finding is supported by the record, and it would have been the officer had a range of conduct here after determining that Mr. Zelaya most likely had a concealed weapon on him. And it would have been ill-advised for the officer to approach him in that parking lot at 2 a.m. Without taking some reasonable protective measure. And so here, Your Honors, I would also submit that that arm raise was similar to the direction in them for the defendant to place his hands on the wheel. And for those reasons, Your Honor, I think that the circuit court properly denied the motion to dismiss in this case. The motion to suppress. Can I answer any further questions from the court about the Terry analysis? As I noted, I think that the ruling from Jones controls here as to that final part. And I would also just, again, in response to the appellant's position, I would distinguish Johnson, particularly as I noted in the Commonwealth brief and the footnote. The ruling in Commonwealth versus Johnson, the standard of review is distinguishable as it was a Commonwealth appeal, which requires the court to consider the facts favorable to the defendant. And I would also point out that Johnson did not address the Terry. To the extent that it may have commented on Terry, the issue before the court in Johnson was probable cause to support an arrest. And so the court conducted its analysis using probable cause as the standard. So I would submit that it is on those grounds that it is very distinguishable from this case. And finally, Your Honors, I would just again reiterate that the situation shifted over a period of time. And so when Officer Larson was first approaching, he was investigating the report of the open firearm, and he was not at that time investigating a report of a concealed firearm. And as that shifted and he came to believe the defendant had a concealed firearm, he had to continue his investigation. And that was just another factor contributing to the totality of the circumstances. And finally, Your Honors, I would submit that the circuit court did not err in denying the motion to set aside the verdict. The standard of review is that this court must affirm the judgment unless it is plainly wrong and without evidence. And here, the circuit court's finding that Mr. Zelaya concealed the firearm in violation of Virginia Code Section 18.2-308 is supported by the evidence, and it is not plainly wrong. The statute states that a defendant violates the statute when he carries about his person any pistol or revolver. And I think that the law from Clark is clear that a weapon is hidden from view when it is hidden from all those except for an unusual or exceptional opportunity to it. And here, Officer Larson's testimony established that he could not see the handle of the revolver until he raised his hands over his head, which lifted the shirt to reveal the handle of the revolver. And thus, it satisfies the statute that it was hidden from common observation until Officer Larson had the opportunity to see it. And it was not because of the darkness of night. And for those reasons, Your Honor, I'm happy to, or Your Honors, I'm happy to answer any more questions from the court.
I don't think there are any, and you have just reached the end of 5 minutes. If you are arguing, and Mr. Pepper, you have remaining 42, so you've got till 10:44.
Well, Your Honor, just briefly, I think that the court is looking at the issue that is fundamental to this case, which is the constitutionality of being seized when there's no criminal activity afoot, that the officer cannot articulate any. And I don't think that we can say that just because a security guard said, I think they might not live here or they might be trespassing, does not raise it to criminal activity. And so I submit that it is unlike all the other cases that have criminal activity. It can't just be that the security guard sees a car parked in the parking lot. Yes.
Mr. Pepper, in Terry, as Ms. Minix pointed out, the facts in Terry where the police officer just saw a guy in a big coat walking back and forth in front of a jewelry store. And that was the reasonable suspicion that warranted a pat-down search. So if that's reasonable suspicion, why isn't this reasonable suspicion?
Well, Your Honor, as I recall Terry, there were three individuals, and they kept meeting back up after they walked by the business. and they and the two would meet up, and then they'd go to a third guy. So the officer was watching three people, as I recall, case of business, and it was very suspicious, and that was the reason that he went up to talk to them, and then he feared that the individual had a gun. So that criminal activity and that behavior, based on his experience, made sense to him, and I think it made sense to him. Before my time runs up, I just want to say, if three of those people were friends, and one of them was dropping the individual off, and they were just having a conversation before the man got out of the car, and then they drove away, these facts would support that. As the court pointed out, they didn't necessarily flee. They drove away. We don't know if they even heard the officer. And the AG saying that the group scattered, Mr. Zelaya stood there. He didn't scatter. So the facts would support that somebody was just dropping off, somebody they knew. But the security guard just saw a gun, which is legal to possess, and didn't want to go up to the car. And I understand that, but that doesn't mean that there was criminal activity afoot. And I would ask the court to reverse the ruling to the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case is submitted. You'll hear shortly. Next case on the docket is Thompson versus the Commonwealth. The appellant had a oral argument. Your list is representing the Commonwealth. Do you wish to make an argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry, I believe that I might have lost you for just a second, but I am prepared to make an argument on behalf of the Commonwealth in the Thompson matter.
All right, we're ready to.
Thank you, and good morning, and may it please the court, Leanna Bennett, on behalf of the Commonwealth.